Well, the corporations are the government. Let's be frank. The White House is peopled and populated by the corporations.
And of course, what we know historically is that when something can be shared throughout the government, it very quickly leaps into the private sector and becomes available to right-wing counter-subversives who then red bait or whatever the current thing is.
And it just dawned on me, oh my God, I am not a killer. I won't be a killer because this is wrong.
From the bosom of the devastated earth, a voice goes up with our own. It says, disarm, disarm.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Friday, May 9th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The Bush administration circulated a draft resolution among key Security Council members today calling for the elimination of more than a decade of international sanctions on Iraq and granting the U.S. broad control over the country's oil industry and revenue until a permanent representative Iraqi government is in place. The resolution, which is to be presented to the 15-nation body Friday, would shift control of Iraq's oil from the United Nations to the United States and its military allies with an international advisory board having oversight responsibilities but little effective power. A transitional Iraqi government, which U.S. authorities have said they hope to establish within weeks, would be granted a consultative role. With the military phase of the Iraq war officially ended, corporations are lining up for lucrative contracts for the rebuilding of that country. Delivering the commencement address at the University of South Carolina today, President Bush proposed the creation of a U.S. Middle East Free Trade Accord. But the close connections of several senior members of the administration to corporations that have received government contracts has drawn harsh criticism from leading Democratic members of Congress. Among those corporations under fire is Halliburton, Vice President Dick Cheney's former company. The reputation of Halliburton took a new blow yesterday when it admitted one of its subsidiaries had paid millions of dollars to a Nigerian official in return for tax breaks. According to the British newspaper The Guardian, the company said it had informed the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission of about $2.4 million in improper payments to the official, who had posed as a tax consultant. The payments emerged during an audit. Halliburton said they clearly violated the company's code of conduct and several employees had been fired. The SEC is investigating and the firm could face a tax bill of up to $5 million in Nigeria. Earlier this week, Army officials acknowledged that Halliburton's subsidiary, Kellogg, Brown & Root, had a far broader role in the Iraqi oil industry than previously disclosed, encompassing not just fighting fires but operating oil fields. Recently, California Democratic Representative Henry Waxman exposed new information regarding Halliburton's emergency no-bid contract to rebuild Iraq's oil wells, and he pointed to the Army's admission that the company has a far more lucrative role than originally believed. Waxman spoke with Jerry Quickly of Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles.
Halliburton has had an extensive record of overcharging the government of the United States or the taxpayers of the United States for work that they have done. In fact, in one instance, they were charged with selling for $85, $16 piece of plywood. And they were even faced with criminal charges for their overbilling and ended up paying $2 million to settle the case. So here's a company that has a record of overbilling, and they were given a contract to charge whatever their costs were, which was a green light for them
to charge
go out
they
and
want.
Inflate their costs.
Yeah, whatever. It's kind of carte blanche. Basically, the government is giving you an open credit card you never have to pay on. Kind of.
Absolutely. And then no one else was permitted to bid on it. So we wrote the Army Corps of Engineers, which entered into this particular contract, and said, what is this all about? And they claimed it was for Halliburton. It's a Halliburton subsidiary called Brown & Root, to put out oil well fires. It was a contract entered into just before the Iraq war. We said, well, this is not the only company that's capable of putting out oil well fires, but they said they had to do it on an urgency basis. Well, after further inquiries, they've just finally clarified to us that the Halliburton contract wasn't simply to put out the oil well fires, and it wasn't a short-term contract. It's a potentially two-year, $7 billion contract to run the oil industry for Iraq. And when we started raising the issues about this contract, they backed away and said, well, we're going to really have a competitive bid for the contract. And so they've said that at the end of August, they're going to ask other companies to come in and bid for this contract to run the oil industry. Well, that means Halliburton's making money all the way until the end of August. And, of course, they may still get the contract after it. But the thing that was so troubling about the response that we got was that they may choose another company to run Iraq's oil industry. Well, the Bush administration has said, and the president has said, the oil in Iraq belongs to the Iraqi people. Why are we choosing a company, and in this case, clearly an American company?
Dick Cheney's company.
Dick Cheney's company to run the oil industry for Iraq. Yeah. It appears that this administration had no sensitivity at the fact that Vice President Cheney made his millions as the head of Halliburton, and he still gets $180,000 a year payments from Halliburton while he's vice president, and that this looks like a sweetheart deal for Halliburton, and that the taxpayers are going to be overpaying Halliburton to do work that it's questionable whether they ought to be doing at all, but even if they should be doing it, why should we be overpaying for that work?
Right. The only reason this information has even come to light is because of, quite honestly, your doggedness in pursuing this, because the administration didn't provide any of this information. It was not forthcoming. It was only because of repeated attempts, repeated demands, repeated requirements for access to exactly what the plans were for Halliburton that you were able to uncover this and make it public, because this was not in any way publicized or in any way released to the public. This is information that was meant to be kept private about the goings-on between the government and Halliburton.
You're right, and they've not been very forthcoming. They still won't give us a copy of the contract, and I can't understand why we can't get a copy of the contract. But I'm now, in addition to being involved in health and environmental issues, I'm the top Democrat on the committee called the Government Organizational Reform Committee, and we have jurisdiction over government contracts. And I don't think they would even bother giving me the information they have if it weren't for the fact that I'm pursuing it from that institutional position. But the Republicans, who ought to be pursuing this information, they're the ones in charge of the Congress. And Congress is supposed to do oversight over these kinds of matters, where the executive branch of government, which is an independent branch from the legislative one, is supposed to be with checks and balances. They don't believe in asking questions that might lead to any embarrassing answers with regard to the Bush administration. It's in stark contrast to what they did when Clinton was in, where they issued subpoenas almost every hour, called people who worked in the administration in for closed-door depositions, went through and scrutinized every email that Vice President Gore had ever sent, did anything they could on a massive fishing expedition, spent maybe $50 million on their investigations that went nowhere, and now they won't even ask for a copy of a contract for a U.S. contractor to be running the oil industry of Iraq. And here you have a real matter that should be investigated, and we can't get them to pay attention to it. That's not the only one, because I run into this all the time. For example, if I could just tell you something else that I think is really amazing.
Please
I wrote to Secretary Rumsfeld, because Halliburton, working through its subsidiaries, in this case through some foreign subsidiaries, was violating the embargo for trade with Iraq, Iran, and Libya, which means that Halliburton subsidiaries were doing business in Iraq when Saddam Hussein was in power. They have been doing business in Iran and in Libya, even though we have an embargo against trade with them. And they get away from responsibility by saying it's a foreign company that's really a foreign subsidiary. And now they have taken the position, while they've helped our opponents in the war on terrorism, that they should come here and profit from the war on terrorism. I worry about the standing of the United States all over the world, and I hate the idea that the United States and the war in Iraq will just be viewed as an opportunity for this administration to shift dollars from hardworking people in the United States who pay their taxes to the corporate friends of this administration. We know that the Bush administration has advocated a tax policy that would reward the upper income at the expense of working people. And I find that wrong as a policy. But to take money from taxpayers and give it to a company like Halliburton because they're overcharging, it's the same thing. It's a shift of money from working people to a corporation that doesn't deserve it if they're overcharging for their services. And we know that they've done a lot of that in the past. I keep on scratching my head at the idea that Republicans who have an image of being managers, fiscal responsible business types, one, they don't have a contract where there's competition, and competition always brings about a chance to get a better deal. So they didn't have competition for this particular contract with Halliburton. On their economic policies, I think the only rationale I can come up with, aside from rewarding their friends, is to squeeze government to the point where there won't be funds to sustain a Medicare, Social Security, health care, mm-hmm. education efforts where they don't feel the government ought to be involved. And the only purpose, as they see government, is to have a military and to make sure that those who have continue to have even more, while those who are struggling will just have to struggle on their own because the government and all of us as a society operating through the government won't be there to help them.
U.S. Representative Henry Waxman, a Democrat from California, speaking with KPFK's Jerry Quickly. Special thanks to Christine Blonsdale and Fidel Rodriguez for preparing that report. As companies like Halliburton, Bechtel, and DynCorp are reaping hefty profits from the rebuilding of the invasion in Iraq, some of the soldiers on the front lines are reevaluating the personal cost of war. Yesterday on Peace Watch, we spoke with Anita Cole about her journey from soldier to conscientious objector. Cole left a lucrative career in public relations to fulfill what she thought was her duty to serve her country. Stationed in China, she questioned if the people she met were really her enemy. But it wasn't until an experience at a routine M16 firing qualification that she realized that she was not a killer.
I went to firing at the indoor range. That particular day when I went to qualify, multiple things happened. When I went to fire, I didn't have hearing protection in this indoor range. And so I ended up in a fetal position at the base of my rifle. And the supervisor of the range, the firing range, said, you know, what's wrong? And I said, you know, and I'm covering my ears. And he's like, you don't have hearing protection. And I said, well, you didn't give me hearing protection. And he was like, oh, get her some hearing protection. So, you know, because it's a deafening sound when you're with 15 other people firing. So then that was very shaking because I became, you know, at basic training, firing was one of the more enjoyable activities. I didn't really think about it. I thought it was really, you know, you had to be focused, you had to be concentrated, and you had to just concentrate on blowing holes, you know, at a very tight diameter, you know, in the center mass of a silhouette of, you know, a human. Center mass being to the chest area. And so that didn't really bother me. And then that day at the firing range, after I got the hearing protection, expended hot breath from my coworker's rifle, burnt my face because we were laying pretty close together while we're firing.
Mm-hmm.
And so at that point, my eyes just started to water because it hit right below my eye on my cheekbone. And, you know, I was a great soldier up until that point, and so my supervisors, they just realized this was not a good day. And everyone was coming up offering me encouragement, trying to, like, calm me down, relax me, and help me out. And I remember the range non-commissioned officer in charge just walked by me and said, come on, Specialist Cole, you're a killer. And that's when it hit me, because my eyes are watering, and I'm trying to, like, focus at a very distant silhouette of a human. And it just dawned on me, oh, my God, I'm not a killer. I won't be a killer. This is not something that I believe in. And I just felt, oh, Anita, how far you've come, because this is wrong. And this isn't going to do any good, and you'll never take anybody's life. So that day, I didn't qualify. However, I when you know on the way back to the range, people were like, you know, don't worry, you'll have another opportunity, because you know, like I said, I did well at everything I was supposed to do. That was the first time I'd ever not done something expected of me.
Do you think if you'd had the earplugs it would have made a difference that you may not have had this same sort of experience if you'd had the earplugs in?
It may have. That really, between that, it really did bring me closer to the being aware of how forceful and violent the rifle I was holding was. It wasn't just something like playing a game or where it was just strategy and skill. It's a very serious game. You know, at the end of that, you know, that piece of paper, or at the end of that, you know, anything else that we would fire into. It just looks like little holes, but when it goes into a human body, there's a lot more than that. And I realized that I wasn't willing to do that.
So is that what you would consider to be the spiritual conversion?
No. That was the kind of knock on the window of my humanity. You know, I'm coming, you know, let me in. However, I'd recognized that I'd signed my contract and I was not willing. But, you know, somebody on the way home had said, you know, if you don't qualify, they can kick you out. And I thought, this is ridiculous. Like, I do my job. I'm really good at my job. I'm very highly awarded. Why is it necessary for me to, you know, fire a M16 or to condition my psyche and prepare myself to see the shape of a human being at a far distance, focus on it, and then, you know, proceed to fire on it? I said, is that really something that's necessary for me? So I went to talk to my chaplain about it, because I had come home and I just did a Google search on M16 qualification and discharge. And what came up was conscientious objector. And as soon as I saw it, I said, well, oh my God, that's my problem. I don't apparently belong here, but I signed the contract, and I'm not getting out of my contract. So I went and talked to the chaplain, like I said, and he indicated that if I wanted to proceed with that paperwork, that'd be fine. I didn't want to. So I continued, and for the next 10 months, I proceeded to become a shell of myself. I really didn't respect what I was doing. It was very difficult, and it finally crystallized. That's a good word for it. When I went to my family came to visit me in Japan, and they requested that we all go to Hiroshima. And I had not been there before, but when I went to Hiroshima, it was a very changing experience. I realized for maybe the first time in this particular way, after seeing the ruins of a nuclear bomb, that I was part of the world's most deadliest force and most destructive force. And I realized at that time as well that I know my country and many other countries perhaps possess the military might to destroy our world several times over. That's not something I actually wanted to be a part of.
At that point,
my family came home after a day's worth of traveling. I went and started to do all the research on everything that I needed to know to put in a conscientious objector application the moment I stepped foot back on my base.
So what happened to those beliefs early on that there were some situations when killing was justifiable, unavoidable, and in fact necessary?
That's a good question. I guess I had just taken that because without really thinking about it very much on my own. Just growing up, well, we go to war, they must be necessary. I really hadn't thought about it critically. And I didn't have the experience anyway to think of it critically. Before you're firing weapons, throwing grenades, and doing this and seeing, you know, the result of these activities, it's very I guess it is a lot easier to think that that's just necessary and unavoidable when someone tells you to do it. You do it.
Anita Cole left the Army as a conscientious objector in November of 2001. She now counsels other soldiers considering their status. Earlier this week, Democratic legislators defeated attempts to eliminate sunset clauses in the Patriot Act. They would have extended government surveillance powers indefinitely. Yet the civil liberties of many Americans are still under attack, according to Chip Burleigh, a senior analyst for Political Research Associates and an expert on right-wing political movements. He spoke last weekend at the University of Massachusetts in Boston on the consolidation of knowledge between private and government intelligence forces.
Today I'm looking at apocalyptic demonization, counter-subversive repression, and nativist reaction and right-wing back-left movements. And I'm going to argue that these are all connected. And I'm going to start by looking at the fact that covert surveillance is about as old as community policing through the public. It tracks back to the 16th century in Europe. And critics of surveillance abuse emerged almost immediately, and you really then have this dynamic that has gone on since policing began. There has been surveillance abuse, nothing new. In the Civil War, most large cities had uniform police and detectives who relied on whole networks of informers, and usually in the criminal subculture. Private industrial security firms in the late 1800s and the early 1900s developed whole networks of informers to crush labor organizing and subversion and this idea of subversion from within. Counter-subversion as an idea is built in the idea that there's a group of subversives out to undermine the country. The first example of this is the Salem witch hunts, where you have a group of people alleging that the pure community, the ideal community, is being subverted by people working with Satan. And this comes from an apocalyptic metaphor found in a particular reading of the book of Revelation. And this reading is that in the end times, the Antichrist comes back and subverts the true community of God. And so not only do you have that metaphor, but you have the specific allegation that there's the building of a one-world government and a one-world religion. Now, segue forward to Islam as the one world religion and the UN and the European Union and all these groups, that's the one world government, and you know where a lot of this weird rhetoric comes from. So let's go back then to the Salem witch hunts. This idea between the Salem witch hunts and what's happening today is a religious and secular apocalyptic understanding of the world that divides the world into us and them, good and evil. It's the idea that time is running out and there is an approaching battle between good and evil that has to happen for prophecy to be fulfilled. Now, that can be a religious prophecy among certain groups of Christian fundamentalists, not all. Or it can be a secular apocalyptic, which sees America as being essentially the force in the world that needs to fight evil. But it still is the apocalyptic metaphor, and it's rooted in this tradition. And this is where you get some of the right-wing stuff now about the government as the enemy in the New World Order. There's a long tradition of people saying that there are some people in the government who stand for patriotism and against subversion, but there are these moles burrowing, these parasites undermining America from within. And so there's always this kind of split. And in policing, then, you get this kind of understanding within the agencies that have the political power to engage in surveillance and repression. They pick up these apocalyptic themes. They pick up these ideas of counter-subversion. And when the state gives them the power to do it, they go out on this crusade against the subversives. And when there's a rollback of that power, and sometimes liberals will stand up and say, too much, you've gone too far, then this counter-subversive thinking retreats into the private sector in corporate security and right-wing groups, and it never goes away. Now, after the COINTELPRO program was exposed in the early 70s, first by the break-in at Media PA staged during the Super Bowl when no FBI agent would be in the office, the FBI files were revealed for the first time. There were congressional hearings, there were media accounts, a lot of the files were produced. And what happened was that there were some reforms passed under Jimmy Carter. And Jimmy passed the Levy guidelines. Well, as soon as Reagan got into office, these guidelines started to be erased by the Smith guidelines. And then down through a whole series of things that we've heard of and we'll hear more about, all of the reforms of the COINTELPRO period have been systematically erased. Now, the one distinction between what was going on in the FBI during the COINTELPRO period and today is that we as yet do not have evidence that the FBI itself is engaged in disruption. And in fact, Ross Gelbspan, in his book on the CISPIS program, the Latin American Solidarity Movement, argues that what the FBI did after it got caught doing disruption during COINTELPRO was it got out of that business and privatized it so that now right-wing groups are responsible, right-wing groups both domestically and right-wing groups that are part of foreign government liberation, anti-liberation struggles who come into the United States to break up groups, that the disruption really now has been privatized. But we don't know because there's so much secrecy under the Patriot Act and other reforms to protect our security that there's simply no way of knowing what the FBI and other agencies are doing or who even holds the files in the day of the internet and databases that are on web. We don't even know who actually is holding which files because, of course, they're being traded. In fact, there's a whole unit within the government now whose job it is just to link up all the government databases into one searchable database that can be shared throughout the government. And, of course, what we know historically is that when something can be shared throughout the government, it very quickly leaps into the private sector and becomes available to right-wing counter-subversives who then red bait or whatever the current thing is. Mostly it's going after Arabs and Muslims, but liberals and leftists as well. So that this kind of permeable barrier exists. It's very permeable because people work for the government for a while and then go into private industry or become private detectives or set up private security firms, and they pick up the phone and they say, hey, can you slip me that document about so-and-so? I heard them speaking at UMass Boston last Saturday. How does this all play out? It's this idea among right-wing nativist groups that alien ideas, often associated with people of color, so there's a subtext of racism, obviously, that this is what will destroy America. And then the real Americans then are us, and the aliens are the people who don't look like us, don't think like us, and don't act like us. Round up the usual suspects, people of color, women who are feminists, gays and lesbians, obviously Arabs and Muslims now, but anyone who stands up against what's happening is, of course, going to be part of the problem in this worldview. This is, in fact, the root of a lot of repression and political surveillance, is this very bizarre idea about how the world works. Not all fundamentalists think this way. It is a combination of fundamentalist thinking and apocalyptic demonization. Black evangelicals and fundamentalists, their prophetic view of apocalypse is liberation in an egalitarian struggle to protect the weak and the poor and the disenfranchised. Very different prophetic view shared by Martin Luther King and the Berrigan brothers. Apocalyptic demonization says those people over there who we can identify are destroying America, and by developing that metaphor, it then means that we get to protect America by any means necessary. Because from a secular point of view, they seek the destruction of all we hold dear, and from a religious point of view, they seek the destruction of God on earth. Pretty motivating if you believe your biblical message in those terms. So as bizarre as that may seem, that is in fact one of the ways that people get up in the morning and justify rounding up Arabs, rounding up Muslims, destroying the Constitution. They are not crazy and they are not stupid. They see the world in a certain way. They're very smart, and they've learned how to package this in a way that's acceptable in a period of great fear and anxiety over terrorism. And it will be very difficult to unravel, but of course, it's our job to unravel that.
Chip Burleigh is an expert on civil liberties and right-wing political movements. Thanks to Mark Weaver for production assistance with that speech. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back, and we'll continue our coverage on the crackdown on civil liberties. We'll listen in as one of our own reporters is detained by the FBI.